Irene Grey, Reel 4. Yes, you were saying much earlier, weren't you? You know, when you were talking about Chamberlain, this feeling of defencelessness at this particular time.
That's right. Yes, our defences had been managed, the forces had been cut so low, I think, unfortunately, and which is happening now, and which worries me very much, to the extent they're cutting the forces. Because after living through it once, the experience, I wouldn't like any other people, any other generation, to go through that utter feeling of desolation and dejection and helplessness, what it amounted to. And after all, this old country is so old and its people, I think it is wicked to even sort of allow it to get to such a pitch, even though it's supposed to be a peaceful era. Some nations I still do not trust, and I think it's quite possible it could occur again with the bully nations.
So after the, you know, you've described so well this sort of fear of invasion, I suppose the next event would be the Battle of Britain.
The Battle of Britain followed on.
Did you experience much of that?
Oh, yes, yes, we did. We used to stand in the garden. At the time, I know we had a little summer house, and when we had any food in the summer, we used to sit in the garden for tea, and you'd suddenly see a barrage balloon rise, and you knew once the barrage balloon started to rise, that was a signal, and then old Southampton would be surrounded by barrage balloons. And then, of course, you did get the German raiders coming in, and a scream and a Spitfire would suddenly appear from nowhere. And to watch, although part of you should have been inside undercover. Some of it, I don't mean when it was immediately overhead. It was so fascinating to watch the antics of the Spitfire, how it could wheel and turn and twist, you know. It was quite fantastic to watch. And very often you'd see the German go down in a burst of flame. It's, looking back now, it's... I can't remember the names of the German fighters that came in, Messerschmitts agreed, and Lightnings, I think. But people used to stand and pray, you know, that the safety of the Spitfire boys up above. Which brings, of course, again, another... I'm slightly digressing from it. But now I'm talking about the beginning of D-Day. I've got on a bit. It was a summer evening, and about tea time, I was like all the other women, busy in the home, fiddling about, and there was a sudden drone of aircraft in the distance. And as soon as you heard aircraft, of course, you were on edge, wondering. You didn't know, as we said, whether it's one of theirs or one of ours. But the noise increased in intensity to such a pitch that it was absolutely deafening, and I mean deafening. By now, everybody had gone out to their gates to see what on earth. But although no word had been said, you knew it was the beginning of D-Day, because the sky was literally black with aircraft towing gliders, not just one, wave after wave. The sky was black. And as they passed, they were very, very low, only just, and I think it was deliberate policy to let the people below know, give them a hint, you know. And as they went out over the coastwards, lots of them dipped their wings slightly left. And although people were out at their gates and by now excited, it had dawned on you that it was the beginning. Everybody was talking, you know. But gradually a silence descended. And you knew that the series descended. And quite honestly, I think silent prayers were being wafted up that the boys would come back again. But that is one memory that I shall always have of the dipping slightly of the wings, as much as say, cheerio, we're on our way. I have digressed, I'm sorry, but talking about aircraft brought back that vivid memory, obviously. And I had a silly memory too, which it doesn't really relate, but I think it's worth mentioning. When I was in control at headquarters during the day, at the very commencement of the war, I know I'm digressing, when nobody knew what to expect, the phony war, as it was known as, people were having their pet dogs put down because they expected bombing at once, and they're thinking about the suffering to animals, cats, everything. One of the men with whom I worked, he was a countryman, came in and he said, "Would you like a dog?" And I said, "No, I'm here all day. I love dogs, but I'm here all day. I can't look after a dog." So, because I was there for actually 24 hours a day, you know, things had got hectic. I said, "Oh," he disappeared. The next day when he came back on duty, I heard him come in at the door and stand still and thought, I sang, "Is that you, Tom?" Not knowing. And he said, "Yes," in a faint, faraway voice. I knew something was wrong. When I opened the door, there stood this air raid warden colleague of mine with the most glorious golden retriever dog on the lead. I could have brained him, because I knew, but he knew rather once I saw a dog. He said, "She's going to be put down tonight." That was it. So I brought Sally home. She was Sally. And she was now, I know, the loveliest gift I have ever had. She was a whopping great thing, the old breed. She put her paws on my shoulder and she was taller than I was. But she was 9 months old when she was given to me. And I was worried to death, wondering how I was going to cope with her. Because also in those days, you had to leave your doors unlocked at night in case of firebombs, so that somebody could get in and tackle them. Within 2 days, this docile, gentle golden retriever had settled herself down in my home as if she'd been born there. And even my husband daren't put his hand on me. She was a wonderful dog. But my problem now arose, how am I going to look after her when I'm on duty all day long down there? We had a big garden, so she had a conservatory door that was locked, the street side, so she couldn't get out, and one at the bottom of the garden. But after about a week, every time I went out, she howled her head off, and all the neighbours were moaning about the howling golden retriever. So the only solution to this was, and by now I'd become very fond of her too, didn't want to part with her. At night, I used to pack up a bag of dog biscuits, if I'd been successful in buying any. Cycle down, leave Sally in the garden in the morning, with she'd at the conservatory. And I used to cycle home at midday, grab my own sandwiches that I'd prepared, and grab her biscuits as well, put her on the lead, and immediately started walk back again. And I took her with me in the afternoon, because on the way down, she could run across the recreation ground. She had to have some exercise. And then when we were in headquarters, I had a steel chain, and I just, when the warning sounded, clipped her onto my desk, and she laid underneath, good as gold, not a scrap. But the times I used that dog, in other ways, at the time, kiddies had been issued with gas masks. They were known as Mickey Mouse masks, little red things with a fluttering nose. A part of my job, mothers would come in during the day with their kiddies to try on the gas masks, where they all write in this sort of thing for assurance. Very often a kiddie would be too scared to try one on. You know, they're frightened of them. My silly old dog, I kept one specially for her, an old one that got holes in it. And I used to say to them, "If my doggie puts one on, will you try one on?" And Sally used to sit in the chair, like an old duchess, on her back. And I put the mask on, and she'd sit there perfectly happy with the mask on. And very often it did the trick. The kiddies wore them on. And the whole of Totten came to know me, if they didn't know their name, you know, the lady with the great big golden dog that goes to works in civil defence, because by now it had been renamed, not area precautions, it was civil defence, expecting invasion. So that poor old dog had her years, but she was part of the civil defence.
Well, were you given sort of ration provisions for dogs?
No.
You know, you were saying about the biscuits, if you could find them, indicating that perhaps they were...
Only occasionally she had dog biscuits. And then in those days, there was no such thing as tin dog foods like you buy now. She had to live just on what we had and share our food with her. Very often, weeks went by, she didn't have any meat of any kind whatsoever. And it was typical of all, and not just my dog. But she lived to be 13. And I look back on her now as the loveliest gift I've ever had, because when my children, because I had the two sons eventually, she was always with them. Doesn't matter where they went, she was there, and nobody dare put a hand on them.
The other thing which was interesting, you know, when you were saying you couldn't lock your doors because
yes.
people had to come in, what was the sort of crime situation as a result?
There wasn't any. There just wasn't any. The streets were black, absolutely black, because no lights were allowed, of course, anywhere. If you went out, you were allowed a tiny torch for your own use, and it had to be only pencil thin, just to show the ground in front of you. But I would have, as I did indeed, walked the blackened out streets with no thought, absolutely no thought of being mugged or anything else. And I certainly never heard of any thieving or any kind. People were more hard up then, far more hard up than they are now, because, say, there was no such thing as social service handouts. But people shared and people helped. And I honestly never heard of a case of theft or mugging on the streets, anything of the kind. We had a school had just been, at the top of the war, just been finished, built. It is a big school now, Testwood Secondary Modern, just down there. And the very first people to use it were the Canadian firemen. They came over as a contingent, and they were billeted there. And the Americans joined them. And then when the Americans and the Canadians got loose on the community with our children, they, as far as they could, some of our kiddies were thoroughly spoiled, because the Americans were very generous. They had good rations, of course, and they'd give sweets to the kiddies. And you could see the kiddies anxiously hanging around a man in American uniform. They got to the pitch of differentiating uniforms, you know, so easily done. But they were very, very good.
Was there any sort of problem with the American Canadians and local young women? I know you were safely married.
Obviously, lots of friendships were formed, obviously, because down at the school then, the Canadians and the Americans, with their own band it brought over with them, used to hold dances now and then, completely blacked out. And, of course, all the local girls, they were invited. It's a free-for-all, you know. Oh, yes, many of them became Mrs. America. You know, went, the GI brides went to America quite a lot. And some colleagues of mine now, with longer memories perhaps than I have in some things, perhaps I should state I belong to Red Cross as well. After civil defence ended, thing I always wanted to do, and of course you meet very types of people and varied types of jobs. But part of the local BRCS people then was escorting the GI brides down to Southampton docks and seeing them safely on board together.
Did you do that?
No, that because I was still then. I had my kiddies. That was before I actually became active.
What was else? That a job which was sort of valued, do you think, seeing the GI brides? Or?
I think so. I think...
What did you yourself think, you know, of women, British women marrying Americans? Would it have been regarded as something sort of glamorous? Or?
I think a lot of girls did think America was the nation to lots of girls. And I, my own personal feeling, I was rather sorry about it. Because, after all, some of the boys came home from the forces, you know, and found the lady friend they'd liked had already disappeared with a yank, as it was known. Oh, yes. But quite a lot of our girls married and went to America.
Yes, they went from Southampton.
Oh, yes, yes. Some may have gone from Liverpool as well, I don't know, but Southampton quite definitely. And not just a few, it was quite large contingents. Because I'm going now on the experience of my Red Cross colleagues that did do this job. And after that, of course, there's a long period of not GI brides, but lots of our own people emigrated to Australia and various places. And then I was involved in that, seeing our own people off who are emigrating from Southampton docks, and many heartrending stories too. Yeah. I look back at my nearly 83 years and find it very colourful to look back on.
Well, I can't believe you're 83.
Oh, well, I am.
And listening to you as well.
I think it probably stems back from the time, I say, when we lost my beloved father. I remember my mother calling us all together, the five of us, after we'd said our last goodbye to Daddy. And so, three girls and two boys. And she was so She was terribly, terribly distraught, obviously, and her whole life had to be reorganised. But I remember her saying to the three of the girls in particular, gathering us together, now don't forget, we haven't got Daddy now to go to, so you've all got to learn to stand on your own feet. But she said, and I want you to still remember the lessons that Daddy's always said, don't you ever tell a lie to anybody, and don't you ever touch anything that or take anything that doesn't belong to you. And she said, I will clarify that. If you ever take anything that doesn't belong to you, this is when we're quite small, I'll chop your fingers off so you can't take anything else. And she really put the wind up in. But how life has altered. But from that day forward, I mean, I do remember she used to say to the boys, don't you start fighting. The only thing is, if anybody does hit you, then you may hit them back and try and hit them harder. She was so lovely.
You were saying earlier, you know, the importance of Churchill's speeches in
yes,
the war.
Yes.
Did you hear Lord Haw-Haw?
Yes, and I used to sit and fume and want to put my fist through the radio and, oh dear.
What sort of things did Lord Haw-Haw say?
How stupid we were to think we could win the war, you know, and this is an Englishman talking. And he used to deride Churchill, call him everything under the sun and all, really rude and insulting. But it was that exaggerated voice as well, what he got his name, Haw-Haw, you know, really. How stupid the English people are, you know, to even consider they could win a war where the master, Adolf Hitler, is the brains behind. Oh, dear, and he used to run our king and queen down. Well, it was the king. Yes, it was, wasn't it then? It was George the Sixth, of course it was, wasn't it? And the Queen Mother, who is now anyway. And they were an inspiration, George the Sixth and the Queen Mother, as it was Queen Elizabeth then, Elizabeth. I remember them coming to Southampton to survey the bomb damage, yes. And the night that Buckingham Palace was bombed, the east wing of Buckingham Palace was bombed. And I remember her remarks then, saying, oh, I'm glad about that now. I can hold my head up with EastEnders. And, I mean, she's still a wonderful woman, isn't she? People that weren't alive in the war do not realise what a wonderful woman she was and has been. They just regard her as the Queen Mum, you know, an elderly lady sitting back. But my godfather, she was with her people, and so was George the Sixth, her husband. Wherever there was bombing, they were there the next day, talking to the people and...
Did you see them yourself in Southampton?
Just once.
Because could you tell me about that?
Well, I couldn't often get in Southampton, of course, but they were walking down the ruins of the High Street, because Southampton's High Street now, of course, is very different. But at the time, it was one long street from the entry down from Winchester. It was one long road, London Road, High Street, straight down the High Street with the sea at the bottom. But it was lined each side with really lovely shops. It was a very good shopping area even then. And the bombers just flew straight up and down. And it was just one absolute scene of devastation and fire. Really was. And during that period, talking about fire, when I was still, obviously, in headquarters control, at the time, all road signs, of course, had been... Again, the fear of invasion. All road signs and directions had been removed. You didn't know where you were. Even a map wasn't much use to. And when, during the height of the Blitz, when the firebombs were raining on Southampton, the exhausted fire crews, obviously, could only take so long, and they had to be reinforced by other crew members. And they were drawn in from outlying districts to augment Southampton, especially at night time in the dark. No road signs. A man that didn't know the road into Southampton. One memory I have is we used to have, when reinforcements were called for, various points known as rendezvous points. The various fire services had been alerted, of course, and a rendezvous point was where they used to have to, on the road, look out for a shielded blue light on the pavement. It was blue, deep blue, but only just enough light showing it was sheltered across the top, you see. And they stopped there and called in and picked up a guide to take with them who knew the area, see, to direct them into Southampton. So remember one night when I was down on headquarters, it was during the Blitz period, we'd put the blue light out because we knew reinforcements had been called for, and a fire crew eventually came in. If I remember rightly, it was a crew from Yeovil in Somerset. They called in to pick up a local Southampton man, or one of our Tottenham men that knew the road to Southampton. On the way in, they came in, picked up their guide, and we managed to give them a quick cup of tea. We were allowed a small ration, you know, for personnel. They went into Southampton. They were there, I think, about 30 hours. They went in with a full crew, which I think was 9, plus our volunteer driver. They called back again about 30 hours on the way back to Yeovil, only just managed to get the fire engine manoeuvrable, working, and there were just 2 men on board. Things like that, you know. But the spirit was still there.
Is having a baby in the war?
Yeah.
What was that like?
I was only one of many, obviously, because, as you said earlier, there was always a spate of babies after the serviceman had come home, you know, for a while. And you could almost plan times, so on. But, of course, there was hardly any transport in those days. Midwives, there's about 1 for the whole area. So lots of women were trained to a certain standard. They were, with the maternity cases, they weren't allowed to do the actual final, in other words, severing of the cord. That, of course, could wait, really. But they could do everything else but that. If you wanted to go to a maternity home, if you were lucky enough to go, you found yourself thinking, well, how do I get there anyway? No transport. The only way you got to a maternity home was if your doctor or midwife considered, especially if it was your first baby and they didn't quite know, that there might be a risk entitled to it. He would book you in, if he could, to a maternity home or the maternity wing in the hospital. But by now, which was evacuated to Oxford, so it didn't. And he would then put you on the list for ambulance transportation. But that was about the only way you got there, because if you had a car, it was petrol rationing, you couldn't go anywhere. I know when my little son was on the way, my doctor did say, I want you in a nursing home. There had been a nursing home in Southampton, a very nice one, but evacuated out to the New Forest. Safety reasons, of course, mainly. So he managed to get me booked in there. And the ambulance called for me about 3 o'clock in the morning. I'd been waiting about 2 hours for it because obviously they were got so many calls on them. And that depended on an air raid if they were needed somewhere else. It was just too bad. You had to get on with it somehow. But anyway, I had my little John after about 30 hours in the maternity home. And you had to provide everything yourself then. You had to take your sheet in, STs. It was a nightmare, you know. But somehow you got through it. And I don't know whether I ought to say this because, well, it's a personal thing and you may not even want it on there and you might think I'm stupid. It was a very worrying time, obviously, if you had a babe on the way. But I say, I knew I was one of the fortunate women having my husband home. Because he had to be home, he had no option. Now, if you remember, I told you my father was an officer in the Royal Army Medical Service, regular service, I mean. I didn't see much of him, because in the First World War, he was away most of the time. I was born in 13, and he was away most of the whole of the war years. When he was home, it was a red letter day. And when I was a tiny child, I had a mop of tight curls all over my head. When he was home, one of his thrills was reading us stories. And he used to sit me on his knee. I was the youngest in my family. And I remember quite well, he was reading us a story, the children's classic of Uncle Tom's Cabin. I don't know whether you remember the story, but in it there is a little, we mustn't say it now, a little coloured girl. Curls all over her head, whose name was Topsy. My father used to say to me, "You remind me of Topsy. My curls all over my head." And he always called me Topsy. Nobody else in the family. But Father always called me Topsy. Right, Daddy died, and years roll on. And it wasn't until this last war episode that I'm talking about, although I'd got John on the way, I was still carrying on in the day, whenever I could, down there with records and things, still thinking about, what's this going to be like? Am I going to be able to get to Spring Hill Nursing Home? This sort of thing. One afternoon down there, I had a violent headache, and it's a thing I've, touch wood, never been troubled with. But I was obviously concerned, what's it going to be like when John arrives? Am I going to get transport? Will everything be all right? And I remember saying to one of the wardens down there, I've got an awful headache and I'm on duty again tonight, so I'm going home to take a couple of aspirins, try and get rid of it. But if the warning sounds, I'll be back. I said, all right. I cycled home and I did as I said I was going to do. I went upstairs in the bedroom, took an aspirin and laid quietly on my bed. And people will think I am just stupid and imagining it, but I was not. I was laying there worried, and so with this awful headache, and without any thought or warning, I felt two hands massaging the back of my neck. My headache disappeared like lightning, but I heard a voice, and I really mean I heard a voice saying, "Stop worrying, Topsy. Everything will be all right." And from that time onwards, nobody will shake my conviction about there being an afterlife. Because nobody had used that word. Had it been any other word? But no, I sat bolt upright and looked round the bedroom to see him. Of course, he wasn't there. Then I burst into tears because he wasn't there. With the sceptics, you know, but no, that stands out in my memory very vividly. I'm quite convinced, you know, that there is more than we know.
The war, what sort of provisions were you given? You know, I'm thinking things like the layette and milk. What was, you know, if you couldn't feed yourself, for instance?
You weren't given anything. So when you entered maternity home, you had to take practically all you wanted yourself. Your own, obviously, your own toilet kit, that makes sense, but these things necessary from the medical point. You had to take it if you were successful in buying them.
Because did you have extra coupons for?
Yes, we had, if I remember rightly, a different ration book. The doctor had to verify, of course, that you were pregnant. And then you got, if I remember rightly, a green ration book, a different colour, which gave you priority in a food queue as well. When you were queuing, if you could produce your green book, you were allowed to go to the top of the queue instead of standing a long time, you see. And if I remember rightly, we got the normal ration, which I honestly admit I can't remember the exact quantities, but about another half on top of that. It was mainly things such as milk and butter and eggs, that sort of thing. But after you had your babe, if I remember rightly, you had that for, again, the same ration, what you're allowed to use for about 6 months, just for the extra food. If you couldn't supply your babe yourself, we had a good infant welfare centre here, and I expect they did all over the various towns, in which you could take your baby once a week. They held a clinic once a week. To me, it was Friday afternoons. You took your babe down and they were weighed, put on the scales and weighed. If necessary, you were given yourself training, how to train the child in sanitation methods and things like this, which some women were dumb. It was very essential. And you could then produce your ration book and you could buy proprietary dried baby's milk, cow and gate mainly, at a slightly reduced price, I must admit, but you could only get it from the infant welfare centre, which again was an encouragement, I think, to make mothers take their babes there because you had a baby doctor there as well to ask any questions, any worries about. She would examine the babe, and you were all issued with a card. I still have my two upstairs, the baby's progress, the first date you went there, the weight of the baby, and the doctor would add on any little bits she thought about the development of the child, if it was progressing satisfactorily, if it wasn't, or the rest of it. And every month, every week rather, you took your babe down, but once a month the doctor would add her comments again, whether how much the baby had gained during that month, or if it had lost, and why, and what were you doing, the usual sort of thing. I found it a very big help, especially with the first baby, in difficult wartime days. I used to take John regularly, every Friday afternoon.